So my name is Vanessa Fong. I'm a professor of anthropology at Amherst College and class of 1996. I am going to interview my former classmate, Elizabeth Knapp, who is also class of 1996. Elizabeth
and
Knapp
your first
is
year roommate.
Yeah, my roommate, and she is going to talk to us about her book, Requiem with an Amulet in Its Beak. This book won the 2019 Gene Feldman Poetry Prize winner. Elizabeth Knapp is associate professor of English at Hood College. She lives in Frederick, Maryland with her family, and she has won a whole bunch of awards. Her previous book, The Spite House, won the 2010 De Novo Poetry Prize. She has also been the 2018 Robert H. Winner Memorial Award winner from the Poetry Society of America, and she was a 2017 Maryland State Arts Council Individual Artist Award winner. So I'm very happy to be able to talk about this wonderful book of really beautiful, amazing poems. And
thank
I'm,
you for that intro, Vanessa. I appreciate that. It's so good to have you do this. Thank you again.
Oh, well, thank you. And today is Emily Dickinson's birthday. So
we
were both
happy
fans of Emily Dickinson from back when we were first year students. And I can totally tell that Emily Dickinson is a real inspiration for this work, both in the content and in the style, contemporary view of that. Let's start off with the title. Why did you choose Requiem with an Amulet in Its Beak as the title of this book?
Well, that's always a good question about the title. The title, I have a hard time with titles, I will admit. I struggled with the title for my first book. It went through several different titles for a few years before I finally settled on The Spite House. And the same is actually true with this book, Requiem. I originally had titled it, I had chosen the first poem in the book as the title poem, and that title is Your Life is Meaningless, and it's in quotes.
That would be a depressing title.
And, yeah, I kind of eventually realized that that might be a little too much, so I changed the title. This one was hard. It took me a while to settle on Requiem. I think I eventually settled on it because I just really didn't have any other good, titles that worked. And I thought this poem was I hope it's a memorable poem and a striking title. And, so that's eventually what I landed on. But again, it took a while. It definitely took a while to land on this particular poem as the title poem. And also, I have a number of, well, at least two other poems in this book follow that, the sort of formula for the title, like Requiem with an Amulet in Its Beak. I have another one called Threnody with a White Ford Bronco inside it. There's another one called Lament in the Style of Monica Lewinsky's Blue Dress. So it's
why
kind
not
of
that
a
as
theme,
a title?
You know? Might be a little too specific for this book.
It might get on the wrong reading list.
Yeah, exactly. But it would certainly be relevant for this time period, especially today.
So I thought it was a great title because it it makes you curious. And, it's not too depressing, like some of the other titles might be too depressing, and,
right.
and others might be maybe too relevant or too specific, making people think that the whole book is about this very specific thing or that. But it's sort of
right.
just abstract enough to sort of cover all of the themes and not limit it to something very specific. And yet it's not like too depressing. And it's not actually any too much of any particular mood, which is great because you have a lot of mood swings throughout the book and even throughout each individual poem. One of the things I really loved was the mood swings, especially when it starts out dark and then turns funny at the end with a punchline. That's a really nice kind of mood swing that you accomplished. And, you know, I especially enjoyed that because it's within such a short poem, you could manage to, you know, go from pretty dark to pretty funny at the end. Two of my favorite poems are the one about you as the actual Elizabeth Knapp in history, a real person apparently who was
right.
a Jordan servant accused of being possessed
right.
by the devil, and the other one of you as a giant herbivore dinosaur. And it's partly
yes.
because I think these two poems are really they remind me of you, so that's so personally I really like them because I could totally imagine you as both of these characters, but also because they have
as
these,
a brontosaurus.
Yeah, that's what I thought, you know, when I first met you. Yeah, brontosaurus. They also, I really appreciated how they ended with really funny punchlines, maybe you can read them, and maybe
sure.
do you want to give the audience a little teaser of how these poems might go?
Sure. So the two that you mentioned are prose poems, actually. I have a series of prose poems throughout the book that are in which the speaker imagines her past lives as various people and things. The first one in the book is called My Past Life as a Dinosaur. It's for my son, who just turned 10 yesterday. His name is Gus. And he, as a lot of little boys are, was crazy about dinosaurs throughout most of his youth. And he's kind of graduated from that now. He's a little bit not so into the dinosaurs anymore. But this was written for my son. It's called My Past Life as a Dinosaur, for Gus. Naturally, I was an herbivore, one of the gentle giants with four or more hearts, and a placid expression I carried even to the end. I spent most of my time grazing treetops, redwoods, pines, yews, anything I could reach. And I cared for my young the way any good sauropod would, by leaving them where they hatched and letting them fend for themselves. The gastroliths in my gizzard churned something fierce, but I didn't mind, because the air up there was so much cleaner. I breathed it in through the top of my head, and when the sky lit up like an electric fence, I didn't flinch, knowing I would come back one day as a superhero.
I love that. Because,
superheroes
so
and
true.
Dinosaurs.
It's so true, and, you know, for those of you who don't have the privilege of having actually met Elizabeth Knapp, that is exactly what she's like. So that captures you, your personality perfectly, even if physically you may be a bit different from that. But I do think you are descended from one of those dinosaurs.
Okay, maybe I was indeed a brontosaurus in the past life. Okay, so the other one that you mentioned, that the second one
Puritan,
is based on a real
Puritan
person.
Servant.
Yeah, and the poem will basically tell you all about her, but there was an actual Elizabeth Knapp. We know about her from around 1671 to 1672, let me just read the poem, because the poem will tell you all about her. It's called My Past Life as a Puritan. According to Wikipedia, I was possessed by the devil from late 1671 to early 1672, a 16-year-old servant in the house of a certain Samuel Willard, a prominent preacher in the town of Groton, Massachusetts, who recorded my possession using a methodical scientific approach highly unusual for the time. Willard, who became my gatekeeper, detailed every moment of my 10-week sojourn with Satan, and later became active in the Salem witch trials, which he argued should be conducted in a fair and legal way. No one knows what happened to me after his journals end. Some reports claim I turn up centuries later on a lark. So there you go, a prose poem that's basically a paraphrase of a Wikipedia article. If I, you know, if a student brought a poem like this to me, I would say no. You can't do that. You can't paraphrase a Wikipedia article. Like, the entire poem cannot just be a paraphrase of a Wikipedia article. But there you go. That's what I did.
What I especially loved about it was sort of the turn of the mood, and I thought the ending was what really made it. You know, that it turns up later on the lark. There's a lot of uncanny things in throughout your book.
Yeah.
Like, you know, a lot of it, and it's a really beautiful kind of uncanny that it does remind me of Emily Dickinson's approach to the uncanny as well. And and you know, you often you're mentioning past lives, and you know, try to imagine Kurt Cobain's afterlife. So you know, there's so much of the supernatural and sort of possibly religious themes. So for the benefit of future students writing dissertations about you, what are your views on the afterlife? Do you believe in reincarnation, like your poems might suggest?
No, I don't think so. I don't disbelieve in it. I don't know. I would definitely call myself agnostic in terms of religious belief. I wouldn't call myself a believer, but neither would I say I disbelieve. I think the only rational stance in terms of the afterlife is to say we just don't know yet. But I would say that I'm an agnostic, certainly open to possibility, all possibilities. I mean, I think it's probably just as presumptuous to say you're atheist as it is to say there is a God, you know? I think that, like I said, I think the only rational stance is agnosticism. But I think it's certainly fun to imagine in poetry, our past lives. I guess if I had to believe in an afterlife, I think reincarnation probably makes the most sense. But that presupposes consciousness that exists beyond death, and we don't know that that's true. I mean, there's just no maybe. You know, I'd like to believe in a sort of I don't know, maybe panpsychism, like the sort of idea that idea of a sort of universal consciousness. Whitman and the Transcendentalists really get into this, same era, of course, as Dickinson. This idea of a sort of universal consciousness that we're all part of and that we all go back to. They called it the float, like the universal float. So they believe that this consciousness was, our individual consciousness is part of a universal consciousness. And individual consciousness returns to this universal consciousness upon death. But neuroscience is sort of actually starting to seriously look at that, that possibility. But ultimately, we just don't know. And it's one of the great mysteries. And as a matter of fact, I have a poem called The Great Mysteries, that really deals with this very question. It's short. Should I read it?
Yeah.
It's a very short poem. One of the shortest. It's called The Great Mysteries. Sometimes, when the wind blows a certain way, I think I can hear the dead laughing. All they have to do is open their throats, and the leaves rattle as the sky makes a little pathway for their party. Other times, it's quiet. The stars burn, but remain hidden. They may be waving, maybe not. So,
wow,
again,
that is
the
really
eternal
uncanny.
Question.
Yeah, that's a beautiful poem.
Thank you.
You know, there's a lot of uncanny stuff that runs through your poetry. Like most of them are uncanny in some ways. Were some of them inspired by actual uncanny things in your life?
Well, one of them, are there a couple of uncanny things that relate to these poems. One of them, it's toward the end of the book, it's called Recurring Dream Elevator, co-starring Prince, and with an unscripted appearance by Emily Dickinson. She's always popping into my poems when I don't want her to. Even like if I wasn't planning to use Dickinson, she disappears. And this one actually, so I had a dream about Prince, about being in an elevator with Prince a few weeks before he died in an elevator. Only the elevator in the dream turned out to be like a death chamber. It was like an elevator that took you down to wherever you go when you die.
And in some cases up, right? Hopefully.
Well, in this dream, everybody was just going down.
Oh,
it's ominous. Yeah, but so in the poem, the speaker questions whether it really happened, but it really happened. This is one of those instances. Often poets will kind of stretch, embellish the truth a little bit, but in fact, the speaker denies the truth, or she questions the truth in this poem. But I really did have a dream about Prince and being in an elevator with Prince a few weeks before he died. So there was that poem. And then there's another poem, it's called Black Friday, and it was published in a magazine called Gargoyle, and it came out, the magazine was published the day of the Walmart massacre. Which was, and the poem is called Black Friday, and it references Walmart, and it implies, it has guns. Well, maybe I should read this one, too, because it's short.
Yeah.
I can read this one. Okay, it's called Black Friday. So that we can kill each other more efficiently, doors will remain open into eternity. 50% off all merchandise, including your sanity. Items may be returned for a full refund in hell. Passing by the display cases, my body could be anybody, out for a stroll in the aisles of America, where packs of app-crazed millennials swipe under the unblinking eye of a drone. At the local Walmart, Camo Barbie sits next to a box of shotgun shells, pink AR-15 included. Because we can't get away from ourselves fast enough, we let shiny objects distract us. All that we see but dare not touch inside the showrooms of our avarice.
Wow.
So, yeah, the Walmart and the gun, the AR-15. I think AR-15 was used in that shooting, wasn't it? Usually it's an AR-15 or something like
So a lot of your poems are just like, you know, like that dark and depressing and sort of uncanny and you know, maybe someone reading them, you know, who knows, you might think, oh, I'm a bit worried about you now. but do you see, like, even though, you know, so much of your poetry is like, it seems like in the first person, it's autobiographical,
but
you also see that, you know, maybe it's not entirely autobiographical. Like, how do you distinguish between you yourself, you know, Elizabeth Knapp, the happy-go-lucky, you know, cheerful first-year student I once knew, and the very dark narrator of a lot of these poems, really sort of, who seems like really just brooding and encountering horrific things. How do you think about, you know, yourself as a person versus the I in the poetry?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I have to really reiterate to my students over and over and over again. Students are always wanting to make the assumption that the speaker of a poem is the poet herself, and I have to sort of drill it into them that the speaker in a poem is always a persona. And this is kind of a modern notion. I mean, it was really, I think, the romantics that sort of brought the poet into the eye of the poem, or really sort of glorified this idea of the individual eye and the identity of the speaker and the poet sort of being one and the same. But as we know from a famous poem like, Eliot's The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, the I is clearly a character. It's an invented persona, right? And no matter how closely that persona may resemble T.S. Eliot, the poet himself, you know, that persona could reflect all of the poet's obsessions and neuroses and, you know, fears and everything. It's still a character. And I think that that's true for all poetry, even that poetry that is clearly autobiographical. So like a poet like Anne Bradstreet, for example, who a Puritan poet who is writing deeply personal poems about her family life, her husband, her children, her grandchildren, she would have considered the I in the poem to be her. But as a modern reader, looking and a contemporary reader looking at her work and thinking about it, I still maintain that that I is a persona, even though it's based on real person. The I is in the poem is based on a real person, autobiographical experiences. William James, actually, philosopher William James, had a sort of interesting idea, theory of the self that I think applies to the poetic persona and the speaker of a poem. And he believed that you could divide a person's self into two categories. You have the me and you have the I. And he thought of the me as being like a separate object or something outside of the actual person. And then the I he described as pure ego. So, like an example, like the sentence, I know it was me who spilled the milk. You see, like the I is the sort of overriding consciousness in that sentence, and the me is the mm-hmm. object. Mm-hmm. So that's how I think of the poetic speaker. In that case, the me is the speaker. The me is the I, and the I is the author. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm glad to know that the poems aren't entirely autobiographical, because I'd hate to see you going through some of the sort of unhappiness and pain that the author seems to, speaker seems to go.
Right,
go through.
Exactly.
One of the most, of course, having known you, especially innocent and sunny portrait of you as a first year student at Amherst College, I keep comparing, your self portraits in the poems to you, the Liz Knapp that I knew.
Right.
One of your most strikingly unexpected poems is Self-Portrait as the Love Child of Kurt Cobain and Emily Dickinson. And that is a great title. It's a matchup that most people wouldn't think of. And it surprised me mm-hmm. because I could easily see you as inspired by Emily Dickinson and similar to her in many ways in your writing and your personality, your life. But I didn't really see that much Kurt Cobain in you, and maybe I'm biased because I didn't think much of Kurt Cobain. And, Cobain actually appears even more than Emily Dickinson. I was like, wow, why is this guy worth appearing in such a good book of poems?
Yeah.
So can you tell me more about why? And are you a fan of Kurt Cobain?
That is a good question. The poem that you're referring to, Self-Portrait as the Love Child of Kurt Cobain and Emily Dickinson, it's part of another series. The book is actually full of series. I'd say the majority of the poems in here are part of a series. And this is a series of prose poems. I think ultimately I ended up with about a dozen of these. This is one, the one that you mentioned is one of the first ones that I wrote. I had originally thought about this poem. You know, I was thinking about, I think the original title was Kurt Cobain and Emily Dickinson and Avoid Each Other in the Afterlife. I don't know, for some reason I just had this idea.
I want to, maybe you can write another one with that title. I love, see, I would prefer that because I love Emily Dickinson and don't think much of Kurt Cobain, so that would be totally what I think would happen in the afterlife.
Right. Well, that, I mean, I think so too. I think Emily would probably avoid him and he would probably avoid her. So yeah, I mean, I was just imagining if there was an afterlife, it seems to me that those two would be avoiding each other for some reason.
That's what I would think too. I wouldn't think that they would do anything with each other that would result in a love child, which is why this is so expected.
Exactly. So this series of poems started, I guess it was around 2014, 2015, Nirvana were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I think it was in 2014, so it was like 20 years after their first album, I guess. And something about seeing that on, I watch the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame religiously every year. And I'm kind of, we're now at the age where, you know, the bands that we grew up with as adolescents are now, you know, it's 20 years later and they're old rock stars now. So seeing Nirvana play, I was never a huge fan, when I was in high school and college. But the music was just everywhere. I mean, it was so, just ubiquitous, like especially Smells Like Teen Spirit. That video just got played over and over and over on MTV. So something about hearing the music again 20 years later just sort of brought back this wave of nostalgia from my youth. And shortly after seeing the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I watched a documentary on Kurt Cobain called Montage of Heck. And it's a really cool documentary. The director has animated some of his journals, his drawings. He was also a visual artist. He had a sketchbook and he painted, he did paintings. And they've animated some of his work, some of his visual art. It's a really cool, very enlightening, also very depressing, very dark, very depressing documentary. But it was, it fascinated me. And all of a sudden I got onto this Kurt Cobain Nirvana kick at the age of like 42. I don't know where it came from. But in about a week, these poems just kind of spilled out of me. And I ended up, after about a week, I think I had like a dozen of them. And, why don't I read the one that you mentioned?
Yeah.
Since it's Dickinson's birthday. Self-portrait as the love child of Kurt Cobain and Emily Dickinson. From him, I inherited a translucency of eyes and complexion, which, in the arena of stardom, means I'm constantly haunted by the glare, his blue veins creeping up my arms like lichen. From her, my Puritan obsession with recycling and a closet full of house dresses. Naturally, I'm an introvert of the most introverted sort. I keep versions of myself under glass where I can occasionally do experiments on them as the mood strikes. Unlike my parents, I didn't drop out of school, though they did engender in me a certain distrust of authority, a punk sensibility in some ways seasoned by their depths. I won't say I miss them. Though sometimes when the wind blows through me, I can almost hear them sing.
Beautiful.
So that, again, that's just one of about 12, and I think I ended up with six, about half of these made it into the book. So there you go. There's one of them.
Yeah, and you know, in addition to Cobain, you have so many other names of people relevant to our generation. Very specific, you know, people, places, events that you know are
yep.
incredibly relevant to our generation. Like you know,
right.
running into Hillary Clinton in the woods, which you use mm-hmm. as a metaphor for the process of writing poetry. And mm. I remember that moment when people were running into Hillary Clinton in the woods and it got social media'd, and that was just incredibly resonant for those of us who are politically aware Americans at this moment in 2019. But
right.
Do you wonder, like, will future generations be able to even get it, or would they, you know,
yeah.
wonder, what, Hillary Clinton, I know that's a famous figure, but in the woods, what, you know, as because that moment, you know, you wonder if history is going to preserve it the way we remember it.
Right.
And similarly with like
right.
Kurt Cobain and like Bowie and Prince and Coco
yeah.
the Gorilla, you know, all these moments that, you know, seem to speak to us, you know, in Generation X. But so I'm wondering, you know, have you gotten different reactions from people of different generations?
Yeah, that's a great question. When I give readings, I will, in fact, look out and sort of take a survey of the audience, just a sort of internal survey of the audience. What ages am I dealing with here? You know, like how much do I need to explain? And so if I have an audience of millennials and, I guess, Gen Z, right, is after millennials, I think we're coming up on, like, some of our college students now Gen Z?
Yeah, the youngest ones are, yeah.
Are Gen Z, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So when I look out in the audience and I see boomers and Gen Xers and millennials and Gen Zers, I think, oh dear. How am I going to make this work? And I will, and I have a good friend of mine, she's 75. She's a good friend of mine. She retired and I took her job and we became really good friends. After one of my readings, I gave a reading earlier, actually it was last week. After my reading, she pulled me aside and she said, "Now, Elizabeth, you're going to have to, one of these days, you're going to have to sit down and tell me all about Kurt Cobain because I don't have a clue." And so, you know, that's the problem with some boomers they may like have heard the name, but they, you know, some grunge guy icon who killed himself, that's pretty much all they know. Monica Lewinsky. So I've got a poem about Monica Lewinsky in here. And of course, millennials and Gen Zers weren't born yet, but I mean, I'm assuming, you know, I feel like with a reader like that, a younger reader like that, the onus is on the reader to get up to speed, you know? I mean, I think Monica Lewinsky, like the people that you mentioned, Hillary Clinton, Monica Lewinsky, who else did you mention? David Bowie, Prince. I mean, these people are going down in the history books, you know? Even Monica, I feel fairly certain people will remember her name, at least, you know, in connection to the Clinton impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
So, and same with Hillary. I mean, you know, if nothing else, she was the first woman
definitely will. You know,
yeah.
But certain moments, like running into her in the woods, like probably future
yes.
generations
yes.
won't really know
yes.
what that meant. What? Hillary in the
yes.
woods? Because it was such a fleeting moment as opposed to,
it was.
Oh, yes, you know, the first female nominee for a major party. Yeah,
right.
But
no, you're
but
right,
what,
and it's something I've struggled with. There was one poem in the book that I cut, and actually it was one of the reasons I cut it. It was self-portrait as Stormy Daniels off camera. It's a poem in the voice of Stormy Daniels. I mean, that's clearly there's another example. Clearly a persona, right?
Yeah, hopefully.
And with her, I mean, I ultimately decided, well, there were two reasons. The first, the poem was just too obscene. I mean, it was just gross, obscene. And then second, I was worried about it being relevant. I was worried about, you know, historical relevance. And I wasn't sure that Stormy Daniels would be a name that would be remembered. So ultimately I cut that one, but it is something absolutely I think about, and I do have to consider my audience, when I'm reading in front of people. And I have to think about how much background I should give, for the poems before I read them. It's definitely something, but at the same time, you know, I want my work to be read and understood by future readers, but at the same time, I want it to be relevant to my era. You know, I want the book to be timely. And in order to be timely, I have to be writing about current people and events and places and so forth.
Well, one of the advantages of how timely your poetry is and how relevant to this particular era and generation is that, I can imagine it being assigned as representing a certain, movement, zeitgeist, generation. But what do you imagine? Yeah. We're both professors. You know, what do you imagine it might be assigned to represent in a survey of American poetry?
Well, again, this is we're assuming that my work will be like canonized and put in the textbooks. But let's go ahead and assume that. And I would say, I think that we're living through an extraordinary period of history. I think we're not just global history, but literary history. I think this is a really important moment in literary history. And I think that this moment will be remembered for its theme of resistance. And I say that because since 2016, the number of journals, magazines, websites, literary journals, magazines, websites devoted to the literature of resistance has just exploded. And poetry in particular, I mean, I think poetry really lends itself well to political, social resistance, and I think that is, you know, this period of history will be remembered for that. I think of the poets of the Stalinist era, like Anna Akhmatova, who is actually one of the poets I quote in the epigraph to this book. She saw her first husband was murdered. Her second husband died in a gulag. Her son was also in the gulag. And she says in one of her poems, "I stand as witness to the common lot, survivor of that time, that place." And I think, that's one of the fundamental uses of poetry, I think, is to bear witness. And I think that's what we're doing right now. And for me personally, that's what I charge myself with as a poet, to bear witness to this extraordinary moment in history.
And you do it really well and beautifully. This book, I can totally see the thematic coherence, even though a lot of the poems were published previously independently. So wondering, why did you choose of all the poems that you've written and published in various magazines, you chose certain ones to put in this book and you chose not to put others in this book. Why did you choose these poems? Like, what did you exclude and why?
Okay. Well, I mentioned the Stormy Daniels poem. I excluded that. Poems got excluded. So what happens when you have enough poems to make a collection? That's really the hardest part, for me in writing a book and putting it together. It's the actual organization. And that can take years. I mean, it can really take years before you feel comfortable with it and satisfied with it. And it's like putting together a puzzle. So, I mean, literally like a puzzle. So I'll print out pages of poems and I'll lay them out on the floor and I'll just kind of arrange them like I would a puzzle. And you look at the floor and you say, well, there's a big hole there. You know, I got to fill that hole. Got to write something. Or this piece, this piece of the puzzle is too dense. I need to take some away. So I ended up taking a lot away. There's one poem that I took away that I kind of regret having taken it away, and I think it was one that you would really like. It was called Self-Portrait as Kurt Cobain's Suicide Weapon, and it was actually written, it's a parody, I guess you would call it a parody of My Life Had Stood a Loaded Gun by Emily Dickinson. You know that poem?
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And now I'm blanking on how it goes. But it's the same meter.
Mm-hmm.
And it uses her random capitalization and her dashes. And it also uses those, those marks that she would, little footnotes that she would make in poems to indicate an alternate word. You know,
mm-hmm.
she'd put a little
mm-hmm.
cross
mm-hmm.
by
mm-hmm.
a word, and then at the bottom it would be like a little footnote, and she'd have alternate words. So the poem does use that formula. Because it was a parody, and it felt more like a parody than like a real poem in its own right.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I still like it, and I did publish it, but it just didn't feel like it felt different from the others, and then it was a parody, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So quite a few, and then like I said, I have a number of poems in series. I have all these poems. One thing I'm really interested in is ekphrasis, which is the poetry that's about the visual arts. So poems about paintings or sculptures or any kind of visual art, photography. And I have a number of ekphrastic poems on blockbuster films. So film can also be a subject of ekphrasis. And so I have one, for example, I don't know if you've seen any of these films, but Minority Report, which is with Tom
mm-hmm.
Cruise. There's another one, Gladiator, which is with Russell Crowe.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, Last Tango in Paris with Marlon Brando. So I have a number of ekphrastic poems based on film, and I cut a number of those. And it was mostly just because I needed to balance the collection. So I was spreading these poems in series throughout the three sections of the book, and I needed a balance. So I couldn't have all of them in one section or, you know. So I was trying to sort of balance and ended up cutting quite a few of those film poems. I cut quite a few of the, not quite a few, but several of the Kurt Cobain poems, and
well, I'm glad there's not too
others.
Much Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, there was a lot of Kurt Cobain, and I definitely realized at some point that it was a little bit, Kurt heavy, and I needed to kind of lighten
up.
Yeah,
I think, you know, I keep thinking he's not worthy of you. You're a much better poet than he is. your poetry certainly is better than his lyrics, which he admitted weren't supposed to make sense.
Were meaningful. Well,
your poetry is very meaningful in contrast to the title of that first poem. But one recurrent theme you have in your poetry that worked really well, I think, was the anniversary poems. And they really sounded like anniversary gifts for your husband, were they?
Yes. Yes, they were.
So,
they are.
So you actually wrote them for your anniversaries and in the actual anniversary. How did he react, and how did his reactions differ from, like, literary critics and students' reactions?
So I write poems for my husband based on the traditional anniversary gift every year, and I give him usually a gag gift as part, like, whatever the traditional, you know, if it's 5th year is wood, I gave him a bonsai, which, like, it's a kind of an inside joke. We kill every single plant that comes into our house. It's, like, impossible for us to keep plants alive. So the fact that I brought, like, a living plant into the house is kind of a joke. So I, you know, gave him a poem along with the bonsai. And he is himself a writer. He's a fiction writer. He writes novels, sort of literary noir, I would call it, crime fiction, literary noir. So he's actually like my first and last reader. Everything I write goes through him. So he's, we have, this one thing I'm so thankful for, my dear husband who gets me, like he gets it. He gets the writing life. He gets poetry. And he's my best critic and editor. So, everything goes through him. So he, of course, loves the poems, the marriage poems, the anniversary poems. Other people seem to love them too. I usually get pretty good responses to them. It's funny though, I started this tradition in year 4, I believe. So I had to go back and try to write the first 3 years. And I didn't like anything except the first year, I guess, was okay. But then after that, they were terrible. So, and I didn't really like year 4 either. So I ended up starting with year 5. So I've got missing years. And I decided I actually like that idea because that's very reflective of marriage. There are years that completely go missing in a marriage. You know, like what happened to that year? I have no idea.
Well, they're very beautiful, and I think your husband is lucky to have all these poems written, especially for him on his anniversary. Very few people, maybe no one else can say that.
Maybe Shakespeare's lover.
I don't know if I want to be the person Shakespeare was writing for.
Yeah.
I think your husband is has a better end of the deal than that. Whoever that person or person.
Probably. I think you're right. Yeah.
So what have been like the best and worst reactions from people who have read the poems?
Mm, okay. Well, actually, this is very exciting. A friend who's also a colleague in my department, she's in communication arts, English and communication arts are together at Hood College. She's a screenwriter, and she worked for many years in Hollywood. She actually sits on the Academy of Motion Pictures. And she knows a lot of famous people in Hollywood, and one of her best friends is Linda Ronstadt. Do you know who that is, Vanessa?
Yeah, Linda Ronstadt, right?
Yes.
Oh? Okay.
famous singer from the 70s,
mm-hmm.
80s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Linda Ronstadt figures very prominently in my childhood because she was one of my dad's favorite singers, and he used to play her records all the time. So I have a poem for her. It's called Elegy. It's a poem for my father. It's called Elegy with a Cameo by Linda Ronstadt. And my friend Catherine had me sign a book for Linda, and she sent it to her. And last week she called me to tell me that Linda Ronstadt had called her to tell her that she loved my book and that she loved the poem.
That's awesome.
Yes, Linda Ronstadt gave me
a
very favorable reaction. Yeah.
That's great. That's a great reaction.
Yeah.
One of your characters, Kurt Cobain were to tell you his opinion, I'd get a little worried, but.
He probably wouldn't have anything good to say. But Linda was just honored at the Kennedy Center, actually, a couple days ago, or maybe it was over the weekend. And she had a few choice words to say to Mike Pompeo. Which you can look that up later. But anyway, I was very proud of her, what she said to him.
Wow.
So that was one of the best reactions. Worst reaction? Well, it's only been out for about a month. So I haven't really had, I guess it's almost 2 months now. I haven't really had too many bad reactions, or maybe people are just keeping their mouth shut. Probably more
maybe Trump's Twitter feed hasn't gotten to it yet. So.
I'm sure somebody in my family is having a bad reaction right now.
So these are very beautiful poems that really come from your heart. But, you know, turning them into poetry that you can publish must be a challenging process. So, like, what do you think is the hardest part of writing them? And what was the hardest poem in this collection to write?
I would say, again, the hardest part of writing a book and putting it together is the actual organization. That's the part that always stumps me. The writing, I don't worry too much about, like, how the poems are talking to each other as I'm writing them. I just write whatever I want to write, and I don't think I need to write a poem about this or, you know, in order to fit the book. I don't really worry about that until I have enough poems and I'm looking at them sort of collectively. That's the part that always stumps me, takes me a really long time. I need many sets of eyes on it. I need other poets' opinions. And then you end up getting all these different opinions and they conflict and then you're even more confused. So that, for me, the hardest part of writing a book is figuring out the order of the poems. The hardest poem for me to write in this book, I'm thinking it's this little poem, Hysterectomy. Sometimes I have the hardest time with the small poems, like the little poems. And this is a short poem. Maybe I should read it.
Yeah, read it.
It's called Hysterectomy. It's like I keep forgetting my purse somewhere. And then I remember I have no purse, no phone buzzing away inside it, and no one around to take the call. It was the wrong number anyway. It was God calling. It was a prank call. But sometimes when I'm very quiet inside myself, it sounds like a widow sobbing. So that poem, it's short, and again, sometimes I have the hardest time with the really short poems because they're short, and like every single word matters, you know? Mm-hmm. And I struggled with the ending. I felt like the ending was a little too over the top. Originally had the moon was in there somewhere, and then, I don't know. I changed the ending of this poem many, many times, and I still don't feel entirely satisfied with it. But ultimately, I just had to let it go. And it got in the poem. I mean, it got in the book because I did like the poem. I struggled with that one. So I think it was probably that one. And you know what? It's funny. That's actually the last poem I wrote.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
I do. I think that's the very last poem that I wrote for this book, was that
wow.
little poem about a hysterectomy.
Well, I thought it was a Hillary Clinton in the woods because that happened so recently. And
that was another very recent poem. Yeah,
like, you know, I was thinking of like how long it takes for something to go into a book and go into press, and you know that must have. That was just. It feels like so long ago, but it was very recent.
It does. Yeah, I know. It's like we have regular years, and now we have Trump years. You know,
it's like
Trump years are like 1 year is like 20 Trump years. You know.
I hope it's not taking that kind of toll on our lifespans. Well, your poetry is just amazing and so moving and powerful and memorable. And, you know, after reading them, I just find myself sort of thinking about them. They're sort of like, you know, sort of words and phrases that just sort of pop out, much like Emily Dickinson's, they're very unforgettable. And this is a wonderful anthology. I'm really honored to have been able to be the one to interview you, and it was such a pleasure to sort of get to know not you, but like a persona that you created after all these years, and thinking back to the sort of happy-go-lucky young girl that I first met at Amherst College our first year. But this is wonderful.
Well, thank you, Vanessa. It's been so wonderful, and I so appreciate your time and your commitment to this. Thank you again.
Well, thank you.